You're listening to World Building for Masochists.
And we're wondering why we do this to ourselves.
Because the differences between our analogs of Tibet and Nepal should be explored in detail. I'm Paul Weimer.
I'm Marshall Ryan Maresca.
I'm Natanya Barron.
I'm Cass Morris, and this is episode 124, World Building in Review.
Of course, this episode doesn't come out for 3 weeks, so this joke might be incredibly dated by then. But you know what?
I love it. Or somehow
writing,
even more relevant.
I'm writing this.
Possibly.
I'm writing this to the con.
As you should. I mean, this is going to stay around until at least Seattle World Con, because elements of this are going
think.
To get nominated for best related work 2024 or such. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I
emailed Ursula saying, should we get t-shirts saying Nepal, not Tibet, and Tibet, not Nepal? She's been receptive to the idea. Well, we'll see if they actually do it.
And you could keep switching shirts back and forth.
And confuse people endlessly.
That'd be funny. That'd be a very niche joke, but a very funny one. Well, welcome, Paul. Tell our listeners who you are and about all of the wonderful and amazing things that you do.
I do a lot of things. Hi, I'm Paul Weimer. I'm a three-time Hugo finalist for Best Fan Writer, a one-time ineligible for Best Fan Writer, depending on how you count it, two, three, or four-time finalist for Best Fan Cast, and one-time finalist for Best Fanzine. That would be Nerds of a Feather for the latter and Skippy Fandy for the former. I do lots of science fiction criticism on the internet. I write reviews. I do podcasts. I boost books and talk about books on social medias, even in this fractured social media age. I also go photographing things and sharing photography here, there, and everywhere. Like all the Nepal pictures from 2019 are suddenly all relevant all over again. Wonder why that is.
So weird.
Weird.
Very strange. Very strange.
Very strange. So yes, I do lots. I mean, I have two short stories published to my name. So what I'm really known for is the fan writing and all the fan writing.
And we're a fan of you.
Thank you.
Very much so. Because we love people who hype books.
That is
so
important. That is part of my remit. And
I know.
And truly, I mean, I do this not meaning to flatter you out of the gate, but you are one of the nicest people in this realm and just a kind, giving, but super smart and funny person. Like, so not everybody falls into that category. I think when you and I first crossed paths, it was another rather tumultuous time in the world of science fiction, fantasy, speculative fiction world. And I was just amazed by your, you know, in general, and also your art, your photographs, which ironically becoming worlds colliding now.
Thank you. That's very kind. Yes. For listeners who don't know, Natanya's referring to the days of the sad and rapid puppies. The first time I became prominent in science fiction, because I got mixed up in all that and got accused of wanting to put sad and rabid puppies in a boxcar to Auschwitz. That was a great time. I thought that was going to be the worst thing that was going to ever happen to me in science fiction. Wrong. Sorry.
I feel like this episode of the podcast is going to require footnotes. Like,
yeah.
Footnotes and editing.
For people who first hear it like 5 years from now, they're like, wait, what was happening?
A decoder then? Ring of sorts, perhaps?
We
can talk about...
If we ever get a transcript up, we'll link lots of things in it.
We can talk about footnotes and annotations later when we talk about world building, which is why I'm here, right?
Yes. It is why you're here.
So what
is it?
What is the latest for you, Paul? Because I think that's probably what's on the top of our minds at the moment.
The latest thing I've written that might be of interest. I recently did a piece called on Ian Watson's 1980 story, The World Science Fiction Convention of 2080, which imagines a science fiction convention in 2080 after civilization has fallen and these few remaining fans believe that they've inherited the stars now because now they no one can take it away from them. And I reread that piece and thought, well, this is rather relevant. This is even before everything broke. This is rather relevant to how a lot of old fans feel about science fiction, about people wanting to be part of science fiction and them feeling it is being taken away from them. And so I wrote a piece on Skiffy and Fanti, dissecting that piece and connecting it to current events. And as events would turn out, it's even more relevant and more topical than I possibly imagined. So that's my latest big piece. I mean, you can always just find just about every week of the year, you'll find a piece of mine either at Nerds of a Feather or Skiffy and Fanti or File 770. Sometimes at Holy Reactor. It's just like, I'm there every week, so I've had multiple. So, you know, it's like, I kind of carpet bomb the science fiction community in a loving way with my reviews and thoughts.
But that was a great piece. I really loved it. And that's what inspired me to go back and reread the Harlan Ellison story, Jeffy is Five.
Jeffy is Five, right. We talked about that. Online,
and
yes.
And then that inspired me to write this weird short story, which might go nowhere, but we'll see what happens. But who knows? It's a new territory for me.
I'm proud to have inspired you, no matter where that goes in the end.
Excellent.
Okay, so it looks like the next bit is I talk about my favorite science fiction or fantasy world or worlds. We just can't pick one either. Of course you can't. You're science fiction fans. Oh dear God, where do I begin? I looked at this for the last couple of days, like, how do I pick? So I'm going to go down the old straight track and just pick the one true fandom of mine, which is all Wars Are But Shadows. And so if you know your Zelazny, you know I'm talking about the Chronicles of Amber, because the Chronicles of Amber got me into science fiction and fantasy when I was about 10 or 11. I mean, I read a couple of Asimov things beforehand, but Once my brother handed me Nine Princes and Amber, there was no going back. It's like, okay, I'm driving into science fiction fantasy and never turning around. I mean, it was multiverse before multiverse was really a thing. And that's been a core part of my interest. I mean, it's been interesting. Like, I've enjoyed multiverse stuff for so long. And now finally, it's mainstream. It's like, everybody loves what I love now. Or at least everybody knows what it is. With all the advantages and disadvantages and problems of trying to write a multiverse story or trying to read or even review a multiverse story. So that's one of my favorite science fiction fantasy worlds. A more recent topical one, I'm going to go with Kate Elliott's Alexander the Great Gender Flipped in Space novels. Those are so much fun. When I first heard she was going to do this, like, oh, this is going to be so good. And then it turned out the three of you know that I'm Tuckerized into the second one, right?
Yes. I actually did not know that.
You told me. Yeah. You told me, Paul.
Oh, that's what I did tell you. There's the unbanned prince in the second one. The unbanned prince is me. because of a
is
different thing that happened
ineligible?
Online. No, he's just unbanned. Unless I am both, in which case he is ineligible. So.
I mean, I think some fantasy book needs an ineligible prince. I mean, I think that's a great title.
It is a great title. It's there for any writer who wants to take that and run with it. But yes, Unconquerable Sun and Furious Heaven do all the things I like in world building and character development and big screen space opera. So. I've been a fan of Kate's work since I picked up King's Dragon in 1997, because at that point it's like, oh, here's the Nebula finalist. I should read the Redman finalist. So like, who's Kate Elliott? I've not read Kate Elliott. I'll start reading Kate Elliott. Wham. I do have a set of the Crown of Stars series that she signed for me and sent to me. So, which is one of my treasured possessions, is those copies of that seven book series that came out at the same time as another epic fantasy series set in a quasi Western Europe that we will not name, that was not finished yet. But she finished hers, which I always appreciate. When circumstances allow you to finish the series, and with all the world building I could want and more. So I think I'll stop at two because otherwise I could be here all night just on this one question.
Well, we can probably weave more in as the episode goes along.
I'm certain I can bring more in here.
Well, and that actually led me to a question. So, you know, finished versus unfinished series. And obviously there can be many reasons why series are finished or unfinished. It's oftentimes
out of the author's control. Yes.
Out of the author's control. But often it is. I mean, there are some series that have sold enough money for people to never work a day in their lives if they don't want to, and they're not being finished. How does that impact you as a reviewer? Do you hit a point where you sort of feel like you're burned on things, or have you learned to appreciate, as some people have, the joy of the fragment, right? The Coleridge approach, right? You know, Kublai Khan is still great because Kublai Khan is great in the context that it has. I mean, we still know lines from it. There may be other series that are
and this stuff is inspired by it. I mean, there's a whatchamacallit, there's a Incomplete Enchanter novel based on Xanadu, where Harold Shane and his companions wind up in the Pleasure Palace and have to escape. So that's a very good question. I mean, because this also goes back to reviewing books in general, because it's like if you wait for a series to get finished before you start, you pick up and read it, it won't get finished because nobody will buy it. So my perfect series is a series that starts with a book that has, I know you mentioned on ramps in our notes before. I'm going to talk about off ramps because this is one of my hobby horses. I believe that the first book of any series should have an off ramp where you have the story. And if the reader is satisfied to where the reader can, if they don't want to go any further, they've got a complete story and they can go off and go on to other books. I'm firmly in the camp that everybody that writes a series should do that. So this way, people are free to pick up a book in a series and try it. And if they don't like it, that's fine. But rather than think like, oh, am I going to like this? I like this now. I'll just read something else. I prefer when a series can give me that chance to get out if I don't happen to like it. And not every series is for every reader. Not every book is for every
reader. It's like the
hammer
and the glass, right? Break glass in case of emergency.
Right.
I like that concept because I have definitely started reading series sometimes. And like, I haven't enjoyed the first one that much, but there was like enough of a hook left at the end that I'm like, okay, I guess I'll pick up the second one and see if, you know, I kind of want to know what's going to happen. And then I pick up the second one and I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that was a mistake.
That was a mistake.
I did not, in fact, need to read the second one after all.
I really feel like the Platonic ideal is that a book is a discrete unit, and you should feel at least some sense of satisfaction at having finished it. And even if there are still hooks remaining for what could be the rest of the series, you feel like you got a complete story. You don't, you know, and that in and of itself is like, okay, that was good. And, you know, if you want to continue with it, then you easily can, hopefully, because more books come out. But you don't feel like, you know, you only got a third of the story because it's not really a single book. It's the trilogy is really just one big book cracked into three giant parts. Not to pick on any one thing in particular, but
it's not, sometimes not even the author's control. Like, for example, when Charles Strauss, his Merchant Princess series came to the U.S., they took full size books from the U.K. and split them into two, just down the middle. Aww. So you finish the first book and it just like stops.
Just ends in the middle of the sequence. It's just like, whoops.
It's like, and then you have to wait for the next book and that finished the first volume, and then they did it again. It was very off-putting. Right. It's only because I like the author's work enough that I actually persevered. I mean, a reader new to Strauss's work would have been completely turned off by that approach. So that's not his problem. It's the publisher doing that.
Yeah, and I think that that's such a huge part of it too. I've noticed, especially the more popular, and I see this a lot in romantasy, right? I write and read an offensively large amount. sometimes I even offend myself. But I've noticed with some of the folks who get really popular, you can tell that the amount of developmental editing is diminishing to get those books out as soon as possible. And I'm currently in the third book of massive books. Like, I'm talking very, very substantial, very, 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 very well-known person. And I'm in the third book now. And I realized about 3-4 chapters into it that I was dreading reading it. And I was like,
this is bad.
And I think to your point about off ramps and world building, it's almost going into that section that we were kind of slyly mentioning a minute ago, where it feels like the world's gotten too big. There's too many characters. There's too many side stories. There's no longer the strain, which is what Marshall was talking about. This self-contained, you just feel like it's a yes, and I'm tired and I just want to regular.
There is, right now, I mean, there's a reason why I noped out of Honor Harrington after around book 9 or so.
Eventually
things just get to be too much. And I wonder how much of it has to do sometimes with, like, I think there's different like lanes this probably happens in. Like, if you get sold as a trilogy, you know, if the publisher buys your trilogy straight out, there might be a different rhythm to it, and it might have less of that self-contained aspect than if you get sold as the lie that we all know it is, standalone with series potential.
No. I hate that.
There's
phrase.
Man, I lean on that phrase. That's how I sold. But I think if you do that, there's more of an impetus to make sure the first one is self-contained, more or less, but still has those, like, you know, it could go further, but it's more self-contained. And then
this
there's
is a
the
complete
things
book,
that, yeah,
but
like,
if you want me to keep going,
there's more than I can.
I have
I
some
will.
Notes.
If you would like to give me more monies, yeah, I will write you more words. But then things, and then there's, like, I think there's things like those really long series can happen somewhere in the middle. Like, it was initially supposed to be 3 or 5 books, and now it's 17. And sometimes that goes really well.
That's
and
like
sometimes
half a
not so much. No, Marshall had a plan. I'm not talking about Maresca here.
I have barely gone off the rails with my plan.
Not philosophy.
Yeah. No, but I can definitely think of some, and I'm not going to name names, but I can think of some series that are like that long. And it's not just sci-fi and fantasy. There's some mystery series. There's some romance series where, you know, 8 or 9 books in, I start getting disappointed with them. I'm like, this is not as sharp. This feels soggy in the middle. But then, like, book 10 will be like, oh, this is amazing again. One that's really gotten me that I finally burned out on, which is kind of sci-fi adjacent, is the Pendergast series of thrillers by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Loved them for so long. Read them long past the point where I was actually still enjoying them. And then they had jumped so many sharks, but they finally jumped a megalodon. And I was just like, I'm out. I can't do it anymore. But that was like 16 books in that they finally got me to that point where I was just like, no, you all have gotten too silly. I have to leave you now and stop caring about these characters.
I mean, on some level, that sort of thing where each book can, like, you can just keep adding another book because it's sort of like, I mean, I don't want to necessarily say sitcom, but it's got that same sort of vibe. Like,
the serialization
just can keep going because there's no necessarily an impetus to stop. But at the same time, in doing that, you get that same flanderization that you might get with
long-running
sitcom where it's, you know, where
six
then
seasons in a movie.
Yeah. Where then each character just becomes their, like, their three tropes, and as you keep going with that, then everyone gets reduced down to two dimensions than one dimension, and because you now have 900 characters who are all one-dimensional, and depending on what kind of series it is, then, you know, are they just going through the motions? Are they just all having sex every 12 hours? Or whatever or whatever's going on, just ad infinitum. And just filling that, you know, do the exact same thing again, whole.
Well, at a certain point, they become soap operas, right?
Yeah.
And, like, that's fine in some ways. My mother's been watching General Hospital for 60 years now and enjoys it. But, like, she at least acknowledges. She's like, it's not because it's surprising me. It's not even because it's good. I'm just attached to it. And it's like, that's fine. You're allowed to be. That's cool.
I mean, I think that's part of the power of series that people get come attached to. I mean, before the podcast started, and it's on air, we're talking about a certain author who has very, very passionate, one might even say rabid fans. We're not going to name said author, because
the fans would come and they would.
Because the fans would come and I'm not going to.
And I've already been
your,
there. I've been there, done that. It was exhausting.
I'm not going to do that to your fine podcast. So it's like people get attached to series and they want more of the same. I mean, I mean, people read science fiction and fantasy and other genres for different reasons, but a large of it sometimes is discomfort. They want that. They want the familiarity. And so they will read, even beyond the point of anything new, endless books in a series if the series happens to take off enough.
That's also the whole comic book industry is
comic book. That's how comic
the eternal second act with the illusion of change. I mean, that's exactly what that's
speaking
doing.
Speaking of multiverses, right?
Yeah, well, and every once in a while, especially like with the X-Men, they'll kill off 95% of the characters, but it never lasts. They always bring them back again.
Yeah, let's depower old mutants. Oh, okay. 2 years later.
Oh,
nope,
no,
not
no.
anymore.
Nope, not anymore.
Nope, we're not going to do that.
Oh, now we've solved death. We can resurrect them all. So,
do you ever find yourself, Paul, like at the crux of that problem of like, you love the series as a reader, but as a reviewer, it's jumped the shark and you've kind of had to re-examine the craft of the whole? Out of curiosity.
Going deep into a series is, and reviewing each book in the series gets progressively difficult. And sometimes I've decided, okay, I'm just going to read these for fun because trying to review it, unless I've been like contracted to say, we want you specifically to read that, review this, I'll just read it and not review it because like, what do I say at this point? I mean, I came across this, although it avoids a lot of the pitfalls. And when I wrote a review, when my review that just came out of Melinda Snodgrass's The Thucydides Trap, the last in her series, it's book five in a series. It's like, how do I review this? It's not a simple problem because do I summarize all four books? How do I give enough information to a reader who's never read any of them to understand what the heck is going on, why they might actually want the series? It's extremely challenging to tackle. I mean, there are reasons why I've only reviewed a couple of your books, Marshall, because after a while, it's like, oh my God, this is a maze. What could I possibly do? Ah, I'll just read them.
I mean, I have the same problem with marketing. At some point, you're just like, look, either you're already in or this means nothing to you. Like,
right. Right. So it's like the book five of a series review is really for people, but people who might be reading book five probably are going to buy book five. So it's, on the other hand, I recognize my position and my value in bringing books to the attention of readers because there's just so much out there. A review of mine helps an author. I mean, we're talking about this beforehand. I mean, I help support an author, even if it's book five in a series, the fact that, hey, like, look, Melinda Snodgrass has a new book is a valuable thing I am doing. It's valuable work, but it's hard. It's hard and there's always the shiny allure of the new hotness when the publicist sends you an email say, hey, look at this. Wouldn't you like this, Paul? So it's like, it's an internal juggling. What am I going to read and review next? And trying to keep up with the series I'm on and see what's going out there because I also want to be informed about who's new, what's writing, but be part of the genre conversation. I mean, I was just about to pick up Kat Corain's book when the news broke out about what she had been doing. It's like, no.
Speaking I'm of not jumping megalodons.
I'm talking about jumping megalodons, exactly. Like, oh, I'm glad I didn't waste the time reading that book. Lucky you got close to the top of the pile, but you didn't reach the pile.
You know what's really weird? Just as an aside, I've had ADHD for my whole life, turns out. I've never gone on insane smear campaigns against BIPOC folks in a mental health break. And I know we all have different levels of it, but I feel like that's not really a thing that's... I don't feel like they're related. And I think it's like another level of like shitty because you're like, oh,
I've made plenty of bad choices, but never those bad choices.
So many bad choices. So many.
My bad choices when I have a nervous breakdown usually only hurt myself.
Yeah, and they're not really that calculated. That's the thing.
No. They're usually extremely uncalculated.
And it's been kind of.
Very uncalculated.
We are kind of in an extraordinary time though where this stuff is so visible and, you know, what you're saying, Paul, is so beautiful that, you know, you do have this ability to shine light on things. And I think so much of the struggle that is happening right now with the Hugos that happened even in Sad Puppy, Rabid Puppy days, it's happening with people like Kate Corin, is that marginalized voices that were not heard as often are becoming more common. And, you know, you've always done a great job of reviewing widely, but there's a lot of folks that still don't. And so, you're kind of going against the tide, and people don't like that.
Yeah, I am very much going against the tide. I feel like I am King Canute on that shore, and it's I'm still going to try to push the ocean back because that's what I do. I've made it my remit to try to read widely, review widely, and not let myself become that guy that nobody wants to review or talk to. Because I can learn new things from reading books and reading new authors and seeing new perspectives. It makes me grow and see things from ways I had never had considered before.
I know, and I'm so happy that there's so much more access to more diversity of stories, because I know when I was younger, I didn't read very diversely, partly because that wasn't on the shelves.
Right.
It wasn't available to me, and I didn't know enough even to go seeking it out. And then I started to, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is great. I love this. So many different candies to choose from.
Like in 2017, when I went to New Zealand and Australia for their national conventions as part of Duff, I had read some Australian science fiction and a little bit of New Zealand. And I've been following their podcast, but I just got inundated with all the authors and fans there who was like pressing stuff into my hands and wanting to talk to me about science fiction. And I bolstered my knowledge of quote unquote down under science fiction and fantasy immensely. It's like stuff that rarely ever came to these shores. So it was a very valuable, wide open experience. And Andrew McRae's Truck Song is still one of the weirdest out-of-the-world books I've ever read. Tractor Trailer Trucks Mating. Let's just leave it at that.
It's very Ballard.
This sounds like the...
What's that?
I was thinking the X-rated, like, Disney's Cars.
Rule
34 of Cars.
Yes, except with Tractor Trailer Trucks. But it's just a subplot of the book. Otherwise, it's mostly.
You can't get a whole novel out of that.
Yeah, you could try, but no, maybe a novella.
Is that where Mini Coopers come from?
I'm gonna say it requires to shift gears considerably.
Oh boy, I did bring the spice to this episode. I apologize. No, I'm not.
It's okay. Sorry. Casted a couple episodes. Our Valentine episode got.
Oh my god. Our Valentine episode was awesome.
Okay, so let's move on. As a reviewer, are there certain things I look for, will bring wise and fantasy and science fiction stories, and what stands out to me?
Paul, you are more dedicated to our outline seriously. Than I think any guest we've ever had.
I'm a professional Hugo nominated finalist podcaster.
Tell.
And yes, while Skippy and Fanti is chaos on the rails, as Marshall can attest, I am the straight man of that group. I have to be with people like Sean around. Somebody has to keep things on track, and that's me. I do have a couple things I pay very attention to. I'm going to start with, and we could go on a whole episode of this long, and that's maps. If you put a map in a book, I am going to look at your map carefully, and I'm going to judge you based on your map. I am sorry, but I can be extremely judgmental. I am not my good friend.
No, I'm
Alex
with you
Matt.
Right there. If you're going to have a map, it better serve a purpose, like give me information I need for the story, and it better make some goddamn sense as a map. You're going to bring up.
So tell us what make good map versus bad map.
Well, like my friend Gillian Pollack from Australia says, I start with the bones. If this is a map of something other than a city or a town or a village or a building, if we're talking about a region and we're showing the topology of the region, it better make sense. I want to see that you're not violating basic laws of geology and physics with your map, with mountain ranges that make no sense and rivers that make splits before going halfway across the continent from each other, any other that nonsense. If you do that and you don't have a good reason for it, I mean, A Wizard Did It is lazy and lame. I mean, Tolkien can get away with it because he had basically God rearrange his map. But even then, Alex Axe and I have looked at the Tolkien map and go, wait, what? No, that's a, no, that, because
mountains don't make right angles.
Not only that, up at the top of, oh my God, now I've gone on Tolkien rant. On top of the Misty Mountains, there are two rivers that start right by next to each other, and you'll diverge the other sides of the continent. Like, what kind of elevation change do you have up there that you could actually make that plausible? That That's no continental divide. That's madness.
Single very sharp.
There's
mountain.
A plate at the top. And there's a spring at the top.
This is definitely, I think I probably there's, still have somewhere the map I made for my like very earliest attempt at fantasy writing. And I'm talking like when I was like 13, 14 years old. Mm-hmm. Because I remember looking at it years later and going, oh, rivers don't do that.
No.
Like, that's not how geology works at all.
No, I've taught a course with Alex on Cat Rambo's academy on mapping and avoiding these sorts of mistakes. So it's kind of a passion of my heart. But more beyond just topology, if we look, as you were saying, Marshall, does the map serve a purpose? Can you world build with the map? I really like maps that are used to help world build the story. Like who made this map? What does this map show? What does this map specifically not show? What sort of political, in a very general sense, decisions were made in this map? You can do a lot with the map. If it's just a slapdash fancy A, B, C, D, I'm disappointed because you could have done so much more.
This is why I love the map in Seth Dickinson's Trader Brew Cormorant.
Yes.
Because it shows the different parts of the world that the story is in, but it also has Brew's notes right. on each part of like why.
Wait,
like,
what?
Why yeah. this country sucks.
Man.
Yeah.
This is the danger of reading books and audio sometimes.
Yes.
Is that I have no idea when there's a good map. And I had no idea there was a good map in that one because I listened to it.
And that's a side thing of my own because I do listen to a number of books and audio, and books and audio that have footnotes, appendices, or maps have a diminished experience for me, especially if they really help world build. That's a disadvantage to audiobooks. That yes, I know there are audiobooks that have PDF attachments and what have you, but that's unfortunately a.
But who really looks at those?
Well, I can't look at that as I'm listening to an audiobook on an elliptical.
No,
machine.
Certainly not while I'm driving.
No, that's not going to work.
You've defeated the purpose at that point.
Right.
Our former co-host, Alex Rowland, their second book uses footnotes extensively in that if it tells its story in the first person, then the footnotes are from a hostile reviewer of the first book. When they did a reading the first time, they stood out front and read the main part while they hired somebody else to be in the back and yell the hostile footnotes.
Well, that's funny.
That's clever.
I will say it can work really, really well. Theodore Goss's The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter has the chorus of the characters critiquing, I think it's Catherine who's the character who's writing the story. And in audiobook, it is so cool because you really do have this sense of the narrative in a way I don't think you would experience otherwise. I've really enjoyed those.
Right. Jen Lyon's Acquired Dragon series has footnotes extensively where the events are being critiqued by somebody else and correcting it. So that's world building in and of itself because another hobby horse about world building is who's telling the story and how is the story being told. And a lot of authors don't seem to appreciate the power of being able to what is the point of view, where is this story being told and told to whom and why and in what format and working with that. I mean, I know there are authors who kind of work their way and figure it out as they're going along. Let's going back to the Chronicles of Amber, Roger Zelazny has Corwin telling the story, but for 4.9 books, we have no idea who he's talking to, but he's talking to somebody about the story. Well, only in the final end, we actually know who he's actually talking to, but you can do that. You can do that from the beginning and show the power of, well, how are stories transmitted? Why are stories transmitted? And the power of the use of the transmission of stories in your world to increase the value of your world building. There's lots of things that authors seem to avoid picking up or not wanting to pick up, and there are tools that can be used to really enrich and enliven the way you tell your story to make a more three-dimensional world to the reader. I mean, in the end, world building is an illusion. This is world building for masochists. We world build crazy. One thing to mention in my introduction, one of the other things I do is I'm a role player. I've GM'd the same role-playing campaign for a couple of decades now, and I GM lots of other stuff as well. And as a GM, I have to world build. I have to create stuff. Of course, then the players go sideways and I scramble fast, but that's another problem entirely. So I understand building giant levels of detail and having details right in case people come across it. But in the end, you can't create an entire world because the world is too complex. But you have to make something that seems complete, that the reader or the player can feel like they're in a trompe-l'oeil, or they're in a complete world, even if it's not as complete as they think they are, because we're pattern-seeking creatures as humans. We fill in the gaps automatically. That's just the way our brains work. So if you provide enough detail, the reader will take you the other way there. So you don't have to have every single detail, but enough that the reader can imagine the whole totality. That is the ideal of world building, having enough detail that the reader can engage with it and fully immerse themselves without you going crazy, putting too much. That, in other words, you can let the reader fill in the gaps. That the trick is, and trick as a writer is, knowing what gaps to have there and what parts to plug in. And of course, I don't think this is a revolutionary statement for the three. World building is fun. I like designing maps and worlds and characters and things just for the hell of it, because I like to build and create things. I mean, my photography is creative. I don't do a lot of portraits, but I'm creating visions of the world I see. It's kind of the same thing. I want to show you this world. I want to engage with the world. I want to be the world. It might be masochistic, but it's something I love.
Well said, especially for this podcast in particular. And I think it lends itself really well to the next thing in our list of things, which is about the on-ramp when it comes to world building, about how you get into the story, how you get into that place where you know enough information to let it keep rolling, as opposed to, I don't think I know enough yet to understand why this person's behaving the way they are.
And you mentioned there are a couple ways to do this. I mean, there is the dunk tank approach, where you just dunk the reader in. And the joy, for those who find it a joy, is to try to work and figure it out. But that, I mean, you can dump a lot on the reader, but you can't dump it all. You have to dump, if you're going to dunk the reader, and you have to provide the flotation device so that they can find the on-ramp to get out of the deepest part of the water and start figuring out how things work, why things work, even if they've just been bombarded with Gideon the Ninth, for example. It's like you're thrown into a very strange world right from the get-go, and you're not handheld, and things start to make sense. But it is, if you don't love trying to work that out, and it's not every reader wants that, then you're going to find yourself in trouble immediately. I think it's easier to do the immersion slowly in. The classic approach is, of course, is to have the newbie approach, where you have somebody who's new to a situation, new to a planet, new to a world. So they're asking the questions. They don't know what's going on. The reader doesn't know going on. But by them having that uninformed point of view, they can ask the questions that you would ask and get into the story and feel their way in. And then you're feeling your way in. That's a tried and true approach. Whereas if you do have somebody who knows what they're doing and knows the world, and you're kind of following them along, they're not going to go as you know, Natania. I mean, they could, but that's very hard to do with any sense of any sense of flow to it. I mean,
they have to have a reason to reflect on their world in some way. Right, like something has to have changed, or they have to be like really appreciating a moment. There has to be a cause to think about. Boy, I'm sure glad that our government works like this. Let me think about how elegant it is. That was a bad example.
Governments are elegant. Let me think about that.
I mean, including your world's equivalent of Schoolhouse Rock is probably not the worst plan.
Well, but Locke Tomb was exactly, I was thinking, what is so virtuosic to me also about those three books is that they're doing all the things that you just talked about in different order, including having a character who literally is a blank slate, and you're seeing this world through their eyes. In the third book, every single book in that series is a complete and utter mind fuck something. Well, like,
in different ways.
In a completely different way. Right, and for me, and I think you, Paul, and a few other people, that is my brain candy. When I started reading Harrow the Ninth, I was like pacing up and down the house, like ranting like a crazy person. So I was like, how did they let her do this? First of all, how did they let her do this? How did she do it so well? But I know it's a very polarizing series too, because I've recommended it. Also, Moira Kirk, one of the best audio book narrators on the planet, who does all of those books. Mm-hmm. Huge reason that I love them. But they hated it. And they're like, Natanya, how could you ever? I was so lost. I hated every second. And the minute that I thought things were happening, I was lost again. So I think that the mainstream, if you're writing more mainstream science fiction, I think you generally have to be safer. However, Gideon did become New York Times bestselling anyway. So it is such a crapshoot, but I think you've got to be good to do it.
Look at Gene Wolfe, really whose books are all mind fucks, and like, but yeah, they sold and are well respected. But you don't casually walk into a Gene Wolfe book. You got to go knowing what you're expecting. I mean, the thing about Thames and New Era is that, like, no one kind of knew this was going to happen, and then like, oh, let's just change it up again in Harrow, and then let's change it up again in Nona and have a blank slate. Is like, what? Okay.
I was thinking about the Broken Earth trilogy, yes, and the Jemison, yes, and how, like, I was not in the right frame of mind the first time I started trying to read that. I was not in a place where I could assemble the pieces, and I put it down for a while. And then when I came back to it, I was very frustrated for a lot of that book. But then once it starts coming together, it's so fucking delicious. It's
chills.
Like, when they start fitting together, it's amazing. And it's just so incredibly well crafted. But you got to want it a little bit. You got to be willing to dig for it.
You got to be willing to mine for that gold.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to shame people. I mean, although most listeners of this are kind of like this brain candy, but I'm not going to shame people who don't want to do that and want a more... simpler is not the right word, a more streamlined reading experience.
And sometimes it's the mood you're in. Like me, I'm very moody. Like, I have to be in the right place to want that, to be able to do, mm-hmm, that. And sometimes, especially if I'm working hard on something myself, I'm like, I need my media to be very, very easy right now.
Right.
That's fine. It's okay.
It's my job as a reviewer.
Sometimes I need to be soft and fed to me with a spoon.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, it's cotton candy books.
Right. It's like, this is a cotton candy book. This is a book that you have to think about. My job as a reviewer is to tell you these things, to present this information to you so that you are informed to know what you're in for, good, bad, or to your taste or not to your taste. So I've been extremely, extremely cognizant of, well, who this book is for and who this book is not for. And sometimes a book has not been for me, as it turns out. So that's, but I read enough that happens, but it's kind of my job as a reviewer to be able so that you can come away whether or not you think this book is for you. That's kind of what it boils down to.
I think that's a mark of a really good reviewer, someone who can say, I'm going to judge this cotton candy book for being a cotton candy book and not blame it for not being.
Right. Yeah. Not
dig for it book.
Yeah. It's like,
and vice versa. I'm not going to blame this dig for it book for not being a cotton candy book when like that's, yeah, that's a good reviewer who can say those things and judge them for what they are rather than what I wanted them to be.
What is the book trying to do? How did it accomplish that goal?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, this actually comes to a thing I've been thinking about. Now, it's a book I've not reviewed yet. I've just finished reading it. And the publicity materials and the advertisement for the book don't quite match what happens and what the author is doing. And I'm still trying to figure out how I feel about that. I mean, it's not a bad story that they're doing. It's actually a very clever story, but it's not the story promised on the tin, per se. It's a very different thing.
The PR department didn't read it.
Yeah, I think the PR department may not have read it because if I was writing that copy, not that I'm a writer of copy, I would write this very differently and emphasize what this book is doing and what it is bringing forward, because it's not what you, not what the PR copy says at all. I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to review this and intersect with what people's zero level impressions of the book are, because before they read my review, they might have read the PR copy and they're getting a very different book, a good book, but a very different book. And I also have opinions about that turn they took, that, but that's a completely different subject, a completely different.
I mean, it can be very frustrating if you set expectations that you have been sold a thing that is X, and
I wanted a chocolate
it's really
cake
Y.
And I wanted chocolate cake, and I got an orange. I taste the orange, but I got an orange. This is not the chocolate cake I thought it was. How do I feel about it?
Especially
that?
If they told you it was chocolate cake. Like they brought it to you and said, here's your slice of chocolate cake. And you're like, but this is clearly fruit.
You pointed it at the menu. You saw you looked at the ingredients.
The book begins looking like the chocolate cake. And then it turns into the orange. Let me put it that way.
So the PR people read the first 30 pages.
Yeah.
And thought their job was done.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently saw the movie American Fiction, which I highly recommend. But it is a very different movie than the one that you were shown in the trailer. And the movie that it is brilliant, but it probably would not have been sold to, you know, mainstream American audiences. And so they kind of had to, like, package the trailer to the thing that's going to sell to people. And
well, and that, I was just wondering if that's part of the side effect of the sort of, I mean, it used to be that an elevator pitch was like something that you did because it was just good to have that in the back of your pocket because you might be in an elevator with an editor, right? And you could literally tell them, you know, this, my book is this means this. But now with the rise of TikTok and Reels and all of these things where people are literally boiling down books to their most basic tropes, they're even doing silent reviews. And someone I know on Threads was talking today that she was tagged in a negative silent review. Silent review is where you hold up the book and you just make faces about it and like you kind of gesture whether it was good or bad or things like that. I think they're very obnoxious. But someone had tagged her in a clearly unfavorable silent review. And like, I don't think people realize sometimes that writers are human beings. And back to what you were saying about the copy, not the curtain not matching the drapes, as it were, in that particular
That's
particular
a different scenario.
It is, it could be problematic. I think sometimes that's because of, again, this fast machine of trying to get things out there. And if they feel the premise that they can twist it and make it more sellable just to get volume out there. And I've noticed that that's happening. And I watch a lot of these reviews and people saying, this was not the bill of goods that I was sold. And then you get this really negative backlash that is not good. And then people end up not being able to sell things down the line. So I think there's just this weird Russian roulette situation that we have of like, are the people going to be behind it? Are they going to be right about what they're doing? And how are reviewers going to then, because you're having to make decisions split second on, I mean, how many PR email, we get tons of them too. How many would you get in a given day? Like there's no way you can go through and make those kinds of decisions. So there's kind of like a glut of content and an expectation of pithiness that we just can't maintain.
Right. There's a couple things I want to go from here. I want to go with reviewers and tagging authors and about who a review is for. And I've trained myself out of tagging authors in reviews because for me, it seems like no matter how positive the review is, by putting it in front of the author, that can lead to pain and people unhappy. As it so happens, because because as the three of you, I think you know, is I am brutally honest and I wear my heart on my sleeve. It turns out that a former member of this podcast found a review of her book, and she was very pissed at me, even though I thought I was mostly very positive about that book. And she has not talked to me since. So, yeah. So I don't tag authors. Here's my review of Queen of None. Here's my review of the blood of the Bloodstained Shade. Here's my review of the Hova Alvi crew and tag you. I don't do that because you'll know it's there soon enough because this is the internet, but putting it in front of your face, even if I give you a 10 out of 10, we're all fragile. We're all fragile when it comes to our art. Like, is this picture actually good? Do people actually like it? No matter how much praise you get for anything, there's always that doubt, always that fear. And I don't want to play into that fear by putting like, oh God, Paul has reviewed my book. I mean, I get people not half joking and say, oh God, you're reviewing my book, aren't you? Like, yes, I'm reading your book now. And so I have to realize again, that's I guess that's the power of me as a reviewer. Power is me as the one of the most prominent science fiction reviewers in science fiction. Did I just say that sentence? And is it accurate? Yeah.
You did. Own it.
Own it.
Own it.
So I have to be careful with reviews can be inadvertently weaponized against people without my even wanting to. So I have to respect the power of my own words. I mean, words, the pen is mightier than the sword. I can cut to the quick far worse than Terminus Est ever could, or the grass cutting sword, or any other sharp blade in fantasy that you want to name at the moment. It's my gray swan deer. There, going back to Amber again, and I got to be careful how my reviews get out into the world, and how and what I have to say about those books, or say about a book, and what. So I mean, so what now? Kind of migrating subject to. When I get to think, when I write things I don't like a book by a book, I do it with as much care and respect as I can. And even then, it's like if I say I don't want to kill your darlings, as it were, with no matter how soft I'm saying that. Well, this third act and this character command, I know it really didn't work. I have to be careful about that because, you know, you put life, soul, and blood into these books, and, you know, it's kind of like those who can't do review. I've heard that's very unkind, but you know, I got to be
careful. A different skill set.
It's a different skill set. I mean, I've had two published short stories to my name, so I'm a published author technically. I couldn't win the Astounding Award, so. I couldn't be nominated for an Astounding Award if I had another story come out. But my skill set is in looking at other people's work and trying to bring the essence of that to someone who hasn't read it yet. And like, do you want to read this? Here's why you might or might not. And this is what I thought.
But you're also someone who goes into it with care and intelligence and a lifetime of other reading experiences. I think the danger is that there's a lot of people purporting to be reviewers and commenting on things that don't have the chops, that don't necessarily have
the reading comprehension skills.
The reading comprehension skills. I mean, I think we've all probably in our careers read a review and we're like, you didn't read this book and someone published this. Like, there's no way, especially with my first book, I had that happen a few times. Like, this person didn't read that. There's no way this person could have read the book and then wrote that review. That's just carelessness. And I think that, you know, journalistic standards are important. You know, reviews are a kind of journalism, and you want to have a trusting relationship with a reviewer. What I don't like is the sensationalism that a lot of these sort of like young up and comers literally try. It's almost like they're trying to get into some kind of like fight with the authors. And on the other side, though, I think the authors need to build thicker skins. If you get upset at reviews, don't read them, period.
Just know
you can't, that's not for you, and just keep writing, keep writing your book.
Go write another book.
It's why I don't, and it's not even because of the negative stuff necessarily. I found out, I made the mistake with my first book. I read far too many reviews, and even the good things got into my head in unhelpful ways.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was like, oh, people liked this, I should do more of it, and also more of this, because somebody liked that, and also more of that. No, that's a train wreck.
No.
Like, You can't do that.
No, you
so
can't.
But that's the thing. Reviews aren't for the authors. They're for readers. And hopefully, in the way you do it, Paul, to help them figure out, is this book for me or is it for somebody else? And just because it's for somebody else doesn't mean it's a bad book.
No, it doesn't.
It's just for somebody else.
It's also a very small world. And I often caution newer writers, especially. I know sometimes as a writer, you feel like maybe you should review other writers' books.
Mm-mm.
But that is a very slippery slope. You never know who you're going to meet in the future. 99.9% of what I read, I don't even share to Goodreads anymore. No one even knows that I'm reading it. I haven't updated it in forever. When I do love something, I am feral. Like, I will go to the mat because I do believe in supporting people that I love and their work. But it's not my job to tell you who to read and not to read. I want you to buy my book and my friend's books.
No, back in college and grad school, I was a very small-time book blogger. And as soon as I started trying to get published, I yanked all that shit down.
Yeah.
Like, nope, away it goes. No one will ever know this happened. Delete everything from my Goodreads that wasn't a 5-star. No one needs to know. This is that's just good. That's just good manners. That's just good policy.
Yeah.
But yeah, be feral about the things you do like. That's great advice for everyone.
Be
not
a fan.
Just authors.
About, be like, a fan about your the stuff you're fanatic about.
Everyone.
Yes.
Be loud about the things you like, and sometimes it's you know if you're not someone who's who is a reviewer, then be quiet about the things you don't like, and it's fine.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about the good stuff, mm-hmm. for the most part. Paul, what are the things though that are your pet peeves of things that are underdeveloped in world building? Like the are there common themes that you go again that we wouldn't do that for me? Like no one here is surprised when I say fashion, right?
Fashion. Like people don't think about
they
clothes.
Don't think about clothes. But I read for fashion. And when I'm like, you just didn't even try, that drives me crazy. It takes me out. You know, people wearing polyester underwear in 1765, just gonna want to yeet the book. But for you, you said bad maps. You don't win maps.
Bad maps and bad geology.
Sense. Geology. Were there other things in terms of world building that maybe you see as a trend lately or that you know, keeps you up at night? I have a few of those.
The basic needs of a city, a society, and not seeing where that comes from or not having a terrain or area that supports it. Like, if you have a fantasy city, where's that food coming from? If your fantasy city doesn't have miles of farmland around your fantasy city, you have a bad fantasy city unless you're creating food out of some sort of creation machine. And even then I have questions about your magic system and what's the costs of that. It's like, so like where people get their basic supplies and what happens and just considering the human costs of, especially fantasy. Science fiction, you can do a lot of hand wavy. But even then, way back when I was reading, Asimov and thinking like, how does Trantor actually work? You realize how much food would actually be needed to actually keep Trantor running? Dr. Asimov, I don't think you've thought this through. It's just the number of ships that would be needed to keep a planet without any farmland going is just implausible. You bankrupt your galactic empire just to keep your one planet alive. But I see this much more in fantasy where people didn't really consider how a society actually feeds itself, clothes itself, gets the materials it needs to do its daily operations. Not to mention just all the consequences of a lot of people living in a city. What does that mean? People seem to ignore the human costs and the needs and all the animals and everything else that goes along with that. It kind of like, if you're not at least acknowledging that fantasy cities are very precarious things as they were in the Middle Ages. And yeah, you could cut up a city and that causes problems, but if you're not even addressing where they're getting the food from, it's like, no, you throw me out of your fantasy kingdom and I'm not coming back because I don't believe what people have got, where people are getting these carrots or potatoes, especially if this is fantasy Europe pre-Columbian exchange and they have potatoes, like why?
It makes me think about, and I know Cass, you know all about this, but there's entire branches of archaeology dedicated to the remnants of human poop. And we know because especially in Roman towns, there's so...
The latrines.
The latrine,
oh, yeah.
That's someone's job out there is to rifle through the remainders that are left there to figure out what people ate. And there's literally, I remember watching
it. So much information you can get out of it.
They're literally carrying them around in huge like trash bags to take back to the lab. If that's been fossilized this long.
Oh, wait, we're having another episode with fossil poop again. I'm not doing that one this time. Like, I've got a different world building bit later. But
people don't think about waste and smells and garbage and urine and
animals and diseases and like we have a disease and it ravages through the town and it feels like it's like a wave rather than the actual way. I mean, now we're living through a pandemic. I will hope that people are actually seeing how pandemics actually work. And maybe I have too high of a standard. People actually can see how this actually happens in the real world. and actually put that into the fiction rather than having this having implausible ways of how sanitation and disease contagion works.
I think people so often think of cities and fantasy cities and historical cities as being like, there's the city where the people are and the houses, and there's the country where the animals are. And I'm like, no.
No, no.
There are animals all over your city. There are pens, there are stockyards. I was looking for some details in the project I'm working on and discovered that, you know, the area of Bankside where the playhouses were in early modern London was also known for fish ponds. For like, you know, man-created stock ponds of fish. Just like be right next to each other there. It's like, that's the kind of stuff that if you're going to feed people and not have your city be insanely expensive to live in, you got to have food closer than out yonder in the county. I mean, some of it can come from there, but people need stuff where they are.
And it isn't even a question of, like, you don't have to, like, write paragraphs and paragraphs of infrastructure. You just have to... It is a question of just making it seem plausible that the infrastructure exists.
Yeah, right. You have your character passing by the row of farmers coming in through the gate with their crops. Like, bam, look, okay, you've acknowledged that there's actually trains of resources involved. Good job. Now we can move on to the plot where you're chasing after the wizard. But at least you acknowledge your city actually needs food. Thank you. Rather than just pretending.
Well, it's the fun things like that that can add obstacles to your wizard chase, right? Like, damn, the gate's blocked because a couple of oxen tried to bring in a wagon that was too damn big.
Yeah,
God damn it, I can't get out that way now.
You've world built and made a plot point. All this in one tasty package.
Bam,
bam. Right, exactly. That's the sort of thing I like when the world building feeds into the plot and the characters and they work together as a tight whole rather than walls of text describing, which was like describing a lovely city, but when your world building actually matters to the plot and to the characters and what they're doing, then your world building becomes alive. The characters feel the dung on their boots and get angry at the oxen that are keeping them from chasing the wizard because they're actually matter to the plot. That's the sort of thing I love when I can get that. Give me that. I want that.
See, it doesn't have to be poop. It can be more elegant.
It can be more elegant. It could be a perfumery that they've run through, and now they're full of the sense of the perfumery as they're chasing this poor wizard. I don't know.
But of course, the things that go into perfume can be equally
bizarre
and disgusting. So,
whale stuff and things I don't want to even think
civet.
About.
Yes, all kinds civet. Of sacks. Civet. I love that there were just people out there who were like, you know, presumably they're falling. Killing something or coming upon a dead animal, and they were like,
and going,
what?
Oday dead thing.
Could we?
You know, if I mixed this with something,
they're like, hey, where have you been? It's like, you know, I fell on this dead carcass, and it must have had some lovely scent glands.
I mean, ancient humans are amazing because anything that could possibly work, they're like, let's give it a shot. Let's take this ocean bug and what if we boil it first alive? Maybe then it'll be tasty.
Surprise! It was great. This works. Let's do this again.
Except for Jim, he swelled up and he's dead now.
Yeah, that was weird. That was weird. But the gods must have cursed him. I don't know what he did.
Or the gods have cursed us all. We're not going to touch that now because the God says no, and we're going to follow God in that regard. Sorry. Well, we'll keep these. We're not going to touch these pigs either for the same reason. I mean that's sort of world building. I love that sort of thing where the chaos of world building in the past comes into today. Here's another pet peeve of mine. When world building details seem too regular, like for example, well, consider we have Babylonian sets for seconds, hours, minutes. We have mostly Norse and some Roman days, and we have mostly Roman names for months. It's a mishmash of all the cultures that we've stolen
and
from
Arabic numerals
and Arabic numerals and all this stuff. And then you get a fantasy world where all the days are all the same sort of format. All the everything is kind of over regularized and as if it was like cookie cutter stamped out of the trope catalog. Like, oh, we will name this harvest month. We will name this running month. We will name this snow month. And it's like, that's have you looked at the months of the year, where they come from and how they don't really
and like
match?
Things like that are possible. But only if they're very clearly engineered to be that way, like the French Republican calendar.
Right. Oh, I was thinking
exactly
that. Yes.
That.
And
but it's because they intended it to be. It was a construct, not something that happened naturally at all.
Right. Right. I mean, the metric system survived out of their efforts, but that calendar certainly got chucked the first chance they got.
Did not. Which is a shame. It has some really charming things in it.
It's a delightful calendar.
I mean, just the whole project of meditating on cabbages or whatever it is of the particular day, I think turned people off. Like, okay, we're gonna meditate on the power of the plant violet. Meditate.
I like the month names though. Like Thermidor. Yes, this is the month when it's very hot. Good job. Good naming there.
Not where all the lobsters were.
Lobster. No, okay. That's a different Thermidor. Sorry.
I feel like that's always been sort of the paradox of the things we talk about here, that if you do that kind of absurd depth where, like, you know, yes, the names of the months came from these three cultures and the names of days came from this culture over here, and meanwhile, numbers and math came from the other side of the world, and, like, if you do that, it's realistic, but your audience is going to be like, what the fuck are you doing?
But again, that it's a trompe l'oeil. You do enough that you can see it, but you don't have to go into the insane detail. It's a tricky game just to suggest that this history is messy and complicated and comes from many branches. It's not 5,000 years of the same empire that has never ever changed ever.
We drew this map 7,000 years ago. Nothing's changed.
Nothing's changed.
Got it right.
God. Oh, God. Let me ask you about your hydrology and what your rivers are doing in 7,000 years. I mean, just look at what the Mississippi has done. You've probably seen that map of how it's changed over 200 years. And it's massive changes just in 200 years. So your river system is not going to be static in your world either. No. Unless it's in a tight canyon, even then the canyon's just getting deeper. So show the change. Show your world has breath and breathes rather than just being a static block going into the midst of history. And now things change because now we have to chase a wizard through the streets. But nothing's changed.
Well, a hero was born, so now everything will change.
Right, a hero is born, now things will change. Like, no.
Finally, the chosen one arrived. Who chose him? You did.
God, I've been fucking waiting for 3,000 years. God.
How do we feel about roller coaster mountains like in the Hobbit films?
Oh my God, no, please. Oh,
speaking of
God.
Off the rails, I don't think there was one moment in world building cringe that I ever had more in my life than watch. I was like, why is there an amusement park ride on the side of a mountain in this movie? And who agreed? Because, I mean, like you said, Tolkien's not revolutionizing world building as such, right? This is built off the backs of lots of myths. It's very cool. It's great standard fantasy. But then to take it to that level... They must have all been really, really high when they were making that movie.
Possibly just convinced that this was... Actually, my pet theory is that they were thinking of the video game and wanted to have something set for the video game sequence.
It felt like because putting Pirates of the Caribbean, like the actual ride in the movie. Like, they knew not to do that for that movie.
And then they did it. And now there's the movies are actually part of the ride. Yeah. And it's just become this Ouroboros of pirates.
It's incestuous and bad world building. And then one feeds the other and they can't tell which one is what one is new. And just cannibalize. This sounds like a going against generative AI. It's just eating itself and just self-referencing itself. And you just wind up with Pablo and Pap. Blah.
Goo.
Yeah, it's gray goo. Yes, it's the gray goo of science fiction and fantasy. No, thank you.
Do not want.
Anything else that you'd like to talk about before we...
Oh, God. Oh, there's so much... let me look at my own notes because I wanted to hit a couple things. I think I've hit everything I want to hit. Point of view. Let me briefly tell you about one thing I liked in point of... Like in in world building is when the author can use point of view to help show us the world better. It's like, we've talked about the broken earth and we already, that was the one I was going to throw up. It's like authors can use point of view in a way to show a world and to actually tell, not show, and make it seem right because it's you, the second person character, or you're using, or to use another heart book of mine, Dune, and you're using a massive third person omniscient, so you can see everything that's going on in that banquet scene and get a sense of it all and convey that to the reader in a kaleidoscopic way that they can then interpret and go forward with. I was so disappointed the first Dune movie did not have the banquet scene. I was waiting for the banquet scene and didn't get the banquet scene. I was disappointed. Like, even this is a key scene in the book and you dropped it from the movie. That's bad filmmaking, bad biscuit. Go back to rewrites. So you could use point of view to help tell your world through the characters by how you relay the information, mm-hmm. through the point of view. I don't think any of you have been to Fourth Street Fantasy, which is a small con here every summer in Minneapolis. It's only about 200. Only about 200 people tops. It's small, but one of the mottos is point of view solves everything, and it's true. You can do a lot with point of view to fix problems with the world building by like who you actually put the camera on. There I go with the being a photographer again. Who you put the camera on, what you're seeing through their eyes, and you can show pieces of the world that might be difficult to show if you're just sticking to one single point of view, which I understand is kind of the default now. Is like we're going for a whole bunch of first person or third person singular points of view. And
I am constitutionally incapable of it.
I did it for one book because I like made that the challenge of that book. But like, yep. Besides that,
it's a challenge. It seems to be what people want, but it leads to a lot of strain to try to explain your world when you only have the one lens on it. And you need to be able to, I think, authors and readers of those authors need to be able to embrace points of view. I mean, you don't need to have the 50 points of view that drives people insane. I mean, that point, like, how do you distinguish these characters from each other? And that's the real problem. But choice use of point of view.
There, though. That's
yeah, right. Choice use of point of view can help render your world and show the different layers of society. Show what's happening in the palace and in the bakery and what's happening as the wizard is running away from our hero, and show your world off in a vibrant and multidimensional way. So that's the last thing I wanted to talk about that we haven't already touched.
That was a glorious place to end the main conversation. That's a fantastic button to leave us on. So, Paul, as you know, we ask our guests to give us some trivia for the world that we've been building live and is getting ever bigger all the time with each new episode and with all the short stories that are going into our upcoming anthology. Mm-hmm. What have you for us?
I have a place for you. Now there's a subject we could spend another hour on, so I didn't name it because toponymy is a completely different subject, and we could talk another hour about toponymy. So I didn't name this place, but it's a canyon, a narrow and steep-sided canyon, one of the deepest on the planet. It's not the widest and the biggest, but no less majestic. We're thinking more like the Black Canyon of the Gunnison more than the Grand Canyon, if you've been to either of those. Think more Black Canyon than Grand Canyon. But the special thing about this canyon, besides, you know, giving a wealth of geological layers and insight into the development of the terrain over millions of years, is this. Twice a year, at the solstices, when the light shines down through the canyon at midday, anybody with the slightest bit of magical talent can psychically sense and see their mind the animals, plants, and creatures that used to live there by touching the eroded layer. They can touch the layer and see the trilobites, the ammonites, the ferns.
Oh my god, that's so fun. Oh, that's so fun. Because that makes me think of like the books I loved as a kid that would show you like
it's my
the
ammonite.
Things like
Oh yes,
you have the like layers
Really,
of the creatures.
Yes, we talked about Animites in Helsinki. Yes, I have a few Animites of my own. Yes,
this was I'm such a nerd, but this was my gift to myself when I finished Queen of Fury, because Ammonites are featured prominently. Because like Paul, I'm a fossil rock nerd. I was telling them we need to do a whole geology episode so I can get it out of my system.
Well, when I was a child, I wanted to be a paleontologist. So, like, I'm picturing those strata with, like, the different dinosaur bones. And now I'm picturing, like, a magical student or scholar in this world who would be like, I gotta touch as many things as I can on this day. I don't have long.
Exactly.
Touch all the layers. Touch all the layers. They'd probably have, like elaborate, like elevator systems, like, hooked up. They'd be, like
scaffolding. Yes.
So cool. Like, oh, my gosh.
I'm certain.
That's so much fun.
There you go.
That's super fun one, Paul. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for joining us. This was a delight, as we all knew it would be.
I'm so glad you asked me to come on. I'm the first like reviewer type person you've ever had, correct? You've only just gone with writers.
I think so.
Regular
writers.
In terms of that being their primary
their primary arrow.
I'm going to be a total nerd again, because like I showed one rock, so I have to show another. No one's seen this because I didn't share you guys. I bought a rock because I became part of this podcast. This is a fluorite sphere.
And it looks like
a world.
So shiny. So
it is like, it looks like there's literally like a cloud surface. And when I saw this, I was like, world building. This is the rock that I have to. And I'm not usually like a carved stone person, but the fact that it looks like, literally,
oh my god, yes, it looks like a world. Oh my god, Natanya, I want one now. Oh my god,
listeners, I'm gonna make Natanya take a picture of that that I can put in the show notes.
Yes,
and the Ammonites that you can appreciate.
Yes, I have outgrown my current shelf, and I told my husband I have to buy. He's like, I don't feel like that's
thus you need more shelves.
And I was like, no, the solution is more shelves so I can put more rocks on there, not fewer rocks, so they'll fit the current shelf, obviously. Anyway.
Or, you know, get creative with, like, wall hangings, like shadow boxes or something that you can display.
Just more.
Display your bounty.
Just more.
Yeah.
Just more.
And that's the philosophy of the show. Just more.
More.
Do more. Hi, you. Thanks for listening to this episode of World Building for Masochists and letting us help you overcomplicate your writing life. If you want to know more about your hosts and the fantastical books we write, links to all of that information is on our website at worldbuildingformasochists.podbeam.com. We also have an archive of all of our episodes and links to more information about the guests of every episode. We really hope you liked this episode. If you did, please do take a minute to tell a friend, shout about us on the internet, or leave a review on iTunes. If you've got questions or just want to tell us how cute we are, there's a number of ways to contact us. We're on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Threads as @WorldBuildCast, and our email is worldbuildcast@gmail.com. We also have a Discord chat room linked in the About the Show page of our website if you want to come chat with us and other fans of the podcast. We'd love for you to share the worlds you're making and help us all build until it hurts.